And welcome back. For years, we have celebrated St. Louis's history, from the fur trappers and explorers to the 1904 World's Fair and, of course, Cardinal baseball, and much, much more. Less celebrated is a world here that only now is emerging from the shadows. The lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, or LGBT, community has long been an active, contributing, influential, but closeted presence here. That's changing. A new book is helping. It's titled Gay and Lesbian St. Louis and tells the story through scores of images and text. It was put together by Stephen Lewis Brawley and the St. Louis LGBT History Project. He joins me in studio along with St. Louis Public Radio arts and culture reporter Nancy Fowler. So nice to have you both with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Steve, let me begin with you. You write in the book that there's an awful lot of missing history with regard to the LGBT community. Why is it important that we try to discover this history?
I think it's important for two key reasons. First, it's important to recognize those pioneers who lived in the shadows, who were very open and out in the past, who may have paraded, who may have been arrested, and those who lived in the shadows. But it's also, secondly, very important for the younger folks in the community today to understand the life that they're leading today is only possible because of the efforts of these pioneers. So it's really important to respect the elders and to educate the younger audiences.
How large a community are we talking about, do you think?
Well, you know, there's the common myth of 10%, which you've heard about for years. And so there have been some studies done on the number of same-sex couples in Missouri and St. Louis. I don't have those numbers at my, in my mind. But, you know, it's several thousand.
That's one of the things I guess we're talking about in terms of we don't know. There's an awful lot about this we don't know because many people, I suppose, are still somewhat fearful about coming out.
Absolutely. In doing the book, I encountered some folks who had some great stories but just weren't there yet and not ready to come out. And so we're hoping that, you know, maybe down the road they would tell their story or lend us their photos for long-term preservation.
And Nancy, this is part of your job because you've certainly spent a lot of your career dealing with this issue, both personally and professionally, haven't you?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I was editor of the Vital Voice newspaper when it was more of a newspaper, starting in late 99 through 2007. And it did kind of dovetail with my personal life as well. And I sort of lived some of the history that I was writing about.
Yeah. Can you give me some sense of how your life has changed in recent years because there has been this removal of the shadows that we keep referring to?
Yeah, well, I mean, the biggest example in my life is in 98, so about 18 years ago, I was going through divorce. I had three children, 8, 10, and 13. And at that time, if custody was contested, you know, by a spouse, then if you were gay or lesbian, you did not get any custody of your children. And so I was sued for, you know, for full custody in that I would have no right to make any legal decisions, or and I would see my children like a few times a month. So... And it was kind of understood, even by my own attorneys, that, you know, you're probably going to, you know, unless something happens, if this goes before a judge, you know, the law supports that, you know, gays and lesbians are immoral and they shouldn't raise children. So it was a big difference. You know, it's a little different now.
Steve, it's a lot different now, isn't it? I mean, in the sense that in the last couple of years, that bus has left the station with Supreme Court activity. The mayor of St. Louis is opening City Hall to gay marriage. I mean, this is quite a transformation in just a very short period of time.
Yes. In the book, I mentioned that the very first Pride Parade here in St. Louis in 1980, a lot of the participants had to disguise themselves. They had painted faces. They wore masks. And then when we had Pride move downtown on Market Street, you know, I had a gentleman come up to me and just hug me and cry and said, you know, I was in the 80 parade and I was hidden. And he said, now I'm walking down Market Street proud and out and not afraid anymore. And he said, I hope, again, that the folks who are here understand how far we've come and that, you know, don't rest on the laurels here. We need to continue to move forward. And, you know, there's a lot of things to still fight and advocate for. But, yes, it was a big deal to go from being masked to walking down the street without a mask.
Sure. You write in your book that St. Louis was the mecca for LGBT at the turn of the 20th century. I think that that might surprise some people to hear it put that way.
Sure. And I think it was a mecca because at the time, you know, as the fourth largest city in America, you had a way for folks who may have lived in rural areas or farms or in the South to come to the big cities and sort of blend in. So I'm not saying they would have been out in the way that we think of being out, but they may have been able to find partners, have relationships. And if there's 800,000 people around you, it's easier to hide that than it would be in a small town with 300 people.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, how did people meet back then before the internet? Where did gay and lesbian people meet each other if nobody could be out?
Sure. In the book, we have a great autobiography mention in 1901, a gentleman named Claude Hartland, that was a pseudonym, we'll never know his real name, wrote a book about his life. And he speaks of meeting other men, but it was just a glance, a look, a common understanding. There may have been some bars at the time that we don't have documented yet. It would have been word of mouth and networking. So-and-so knows someone who, you know, they may have dinner parties and that sort of thing where gays and lesbians could get to know each other and have an underground network, I would say, probably developed.
There's a very active bar scene these days, is there not?
Yeah, St. Louis LGBT bar scene is actually quite large. We probably have as many, if not even more, than some larger cities. St. Louis, over the years, has had about 120 LGBT bars, or the earliest bars we know of are from the 30s. Entre Nous and Dante's Inferno are well known from that time. Currently, there is a very active entertainment scene, I would call it, where you have bars, where you have a lot of the bars support sports leagues still, and you have entertainment, whether that be burlesque or drag show type programming. So the history of St. Louis's bars is important in the book because it did provide a place for folks to feel comfortable. But yet, back in the day, it was scary because a bar could be raided just for being gay, or if it was a drag show, it was illegal to do masquerading. So it was risky to even go to a bar through the 60s in St. Louis.
Who are some of the people over the course of more recent history who have been helpful for the LGBT cause?
Well, we certainly have had strong support from the mayors. Both Mayor Bosley and Mayor Harmon were very supportive of the LGBT community, with Mayor Bosley being the first to go to a Pride event. And then we had Mayor Harmon with the same-sex registry work. Obviously, Mayor Slay has been a pioneer nationally, especially over the last couple of years with the same-sex unions taking place in his office and in City Hall. So from that perspective, you have famous people that we know of, like Tennessee Williams, William Burroughs. Now we have Andy Cohen. But my book really focuses on the quiet folks who will never know their names, but we have – it's just, you know, like any – the straight counterparts, doctors, lawyers, teachers. Rodney Wilson was the gentleman teacher in Melville School District who created LGBT History Month back in 94. So there are so many people from all walks of life in the LGBT community that have really done an amazing job of just living their life. Most of them tell me, we didn't set out to do something remarkable. We did it, and now we're told it's remarkable.
Nancy, yeah. What was the inspiration for your coming out?
Oh, Don, that may be a story for a longer story for another time. But let's see, the sort of the snapshot. It was just something I probably always knew when I look back in retrospect, mm-hmm. That I began to identify, you know, as I got older and met people. And actually, truthfully, as you know, it had a name, you know, I mean, people could say the word lesbian, finally, a little bit, in mm-hmm. whispers. Ellen DeGeneres came out on her show. I mean, that alone, you know.
That was huge.
Yeah.
It was huge.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, just a process.
And how comfortable, uncomfortable was it for you during those early days?
Well, it was very uncomfortable. I mean, it was, you know, a situation where I didn't really have words, you know, for it. And then I had, you know, three children, and although I had raised them to, you know, people are different, there are all kinds of people, you know, certainly it was a shock, and their life was going to be different. And I did not lose custody of them, by the way, as it turned out. But so, yeah, it was uncomfortable. But I mean, the custody thing was the scariest part. And then, of course, they faced some ridicule in school, you know, as well. I mean, it was still, this was, you know, again, 15, 18 years ago. So certainly things have changed.
And how were they able to handle that?
You know, there's probably things and situations that I still don't know. But, you know, what I do know is that, you know, like my youngest did his senior paper on same-sex marriage rights. You know, my daughter in her women's rights class in college interviewed me about my custody experience. And so, you know, they went on to become, you know, activists in their way and understand more about differences.
Good. Well, I'm sure that makes you feel proud of them for
having
accepted it in this way.
So proud.
Steve, what is the Mandrake Society?
The Mandrake Society, as far as we know, is the first formal sort of LGBT civil rights group that we know of. And it was formed sometime in 1969 through some students and others at Washington University. And it just got started in April of that year. And then October of that year, St. Louis had its own version of Stonewall occur. And what happened was that nine men were out for Halloween. And back then, the gay strip was on Olive and Grand there. And there was a bar called the Onyx Room. And sometime right after midnight, which would have been November now, these nine gentlemen in drag were arrested. And they were supposedly, you know, loud and causing trouble and all this. There's lots of back and forth about what really happened. So these nine gentlemen were arrested and taken down to the police station. And back then we didn't have, you know, the modern technology. So someone thought of the Mandrake Group as someone to reach out to. So the Mandrake Society's mobilized, and they got folks to go down to the police station and raise money to bail these folks out. And one of the gentlemen who was arrested, we've interviewed. We have an oral history of his story, Greg Smith. And he was featured in the History Museum's 250 exhibit last year. And the Mandrake Society, because of their efforts to mobilize, and that sort of was their a foundation for them. And so over the next several years, as a way to kind of sort of protest these nine men who were never charged, it was dropped, they started having a drag ball. It was called the Mandrake Society Ball. And they had at least three or four of these balls. And they had them on Halloween, which was a way to sort of rub in the nose of the police that you arrested us.
Sure.
And it was really a forming moment in St. Louis to have that sort of structure in place. And then from there, several other things occurred in the early 70s. The lesbian community was very mobilized through Moonstorm, which was a very early lesbian feminist publication, and other activities. So we owe a lot to Mandrake for their effort.
You referenced Stonewall. I'm not sure that everybody knows exactly what you're talking about.
Sure. Well, I mean, most folks who know anything about gay history, they really kind of know about Harvey Milk in San Francisco.
Sure.
They sort of know about the Stonewall riots in New York in 69, which would have been the same year as the St. Louis arrest, where after lots of harassment over years, the police raided a bar, the Stonewall Inn, and there was a several-day very contentious, violent back and forth between protesters and the police. And so when I talk about the St. Louis version of that, of course ours wasn't of that level, but it does have a comparison of, you know, we're not going to take this anymore.
Sure.
We're going to fight back.
That's why I wanted to clarify, because Stonewall was a violent episode.
Sure, and, yeah, so it wasn't violent,
right?
Not here in St. Louis.
Nancy, what about laws and changing laws? How much progress has there been here in recent years? I mean, we're aware of Supreme Court decisions and some of the things I alluded to before, but are there others that can be pointed to that have been helpful?
Yeah, I mean, the marriage decision has been the most helpful, but you know, Missouri still does not have protections for employment and in housing. And that's been, you know, year after year after year in the legislature. Mona is the bill has been advanced. And so the saying is now that you can get married on Saturday and fired on Monday, you know, because that may be how your employer finds out, you know, that you're gay or lesbian. And so that's something that, you know, activists are working on right now is to, you know, there's such a patchwork now of equality and inequality.
Is that the main front, do you think, right now in this whole story?
That certainly is a keystone right now, employment mm-hmm. and discrimination in employment and housing, which tend to go together far as the law is concerned. I mean, one of the first major things was when in Lawrence v. Texas, it was 2003, when sodomy was no longer criminalized. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't something that was necessarily enforced, but it was one of those things you could use to enforce when you wanted to, and also to sort of, to in the minds of people, criminalize an entire population and sort of demoralize an entire population. So that had a huge effect because then our very lives weren't criminal. So that then paved the way for some of these other advances. And you know, marriage is important even for people that don't want to get married because it's just another way that, you know, people have choices just like everybody else. So
Steve, where do you think we are now in this whole history in terms of where we are and where we have to go? Is it a legal battle now? Is that the front?
I think it's important that we don't, you know, rest on the successes that we've, you know, the community may have had the last few years and not be, okay, well, we've come a long way and let's take a break. And that, as we were talking about the job discrimination issues, you know, it's important that especially the younger audiences understand that, you know, elections matter. And so they need to pay attention to the elections and the Supreme Court issues, the fact that the next president's going to either be able to advance some of this or possibly try to turn the clock backwards. Mm. A lot of President Obama's efforts have been executive orders in that which could be rescinded. And so it's important to be aware and educated not only about the history but where we are today. So it's vital that folks, you know, use modern technology, you know, to, you know, use your apps to stay current. As well as read your history books.
Yeah, I want to say, I mean, the importance now of the transgender community, and that's the group that now is the most oppressed and, you know, legally and in every other way. So, like, that's definitely at the forefront of the activism right now.
Well, what about the Caitlyn Jenner part of that story? I mean, that obviously that got a tremendous amount of publicity, and if there's anything recently that's happened to just propel this into the not only the front pages but into the public mind. But I detected during the discussion about this that Caitlyn Jenner was made fun of, ridiculed, and that was, you know, that kind of offset some of the other part of it.
Yes, I mean, she's been a lightning rod. For sure. I mean, good, you know, that she increased visibility about mm-hmm. especially older transgender people. Bad in some people's minds. I've heard many people say, why did she have to wear a white corset and, you know, appear the way she did on the cover of Vanity Fair magazine? Because that's a stereotype, you know, that very sexualized sort of appearance. So it was definitely a double-edged sword.
Do you think helpful, harmful, Steve?
Well, and I think what's happened is, I think maybe Caitlyn's publicity is egged this on, is that you've had now cases where the whole thing about gender-neutral bathrooms has come up. And there was the case, I believe it was in Texas. I think it was Houston where mm-hmm. that occurred. And so there's stuff being put on ballots or efforts being made to use this whole bathroom strategy.
Well, it's even closer than Houston. It happened, was it Jefferson County, I think?
Right.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, Lila Perry. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the transgender story is sort of the next target for those who maybe, you know, are on the anti-LGBT side of the equation. And that's something that we're seeing and that people need to pay attention to.
Yeah.
Are you surprised at the speed with which some of this is moving? I mean, you're talking about a history. You take the history back to before St. Louis was even a city. I mean, there's a long history here, and the movement has been very, very slow. But again, in the last decade.
It's and the momentum has been tremendous in the last decade. It's just, it seems like we reached a critical mass. And certainly there's been a lot of change. Can I ask you something, Don?
Yeah.
So you were in television during, you know, the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Yeah. And I'm just curious how, you know, gay pride or any sort of events were covered and what they chose to focus on. Do you remember any of that?
Yes, I do remember a lot of it. And I'll tell you, you're not going to be, well, you probably know because you were here and you were watching it yourself. But I remember in the Central West End and the Halloween parades and the costumes. And I mean, some of them were quite outrageous in many ways, but basically it was all made fun of. It was it was joked about. You know, it's inconsequential. But that was definitely the approach that was taken. I can't remember any coverage of this as a serious human rights anti-discrimination issue.
Until about when, would you say?
Recently. I mean, within the last couple of years.
Really?
No, and I'll have to think about putting my finger on what I think was a point, but some things were happening, just like the Caitlyn Jenner thing. When that happened, it changed everything, I think, to a very, very large degree. You agree with that?
I don't – it was certainly one of the many things that changed things. I mean, maybe more for people that aren't in my world. Maybe it wasn't – if you weren't aware – of a transgender community before, then you certainly were after, you know, Caitlyn Jenner. So probably, yes, for a lot of people, that was maybe their first awareness.
The actress, I can't think of her name, in Orange is the New Black.
Right, exactly.
Laverne or something, yeah.
But, oh, my gosh.
She's from Belleville.
Pardon?
She's from Belleville? Belleville. Okay.
Yeah.
Laverne Cox is her name.
Exactly. And,
yes.
And that was another. I'll tell you, one of the things that I would point to would be, as you mentioned a moment ago, Ellen DeGeneres. I think that was a very, very important step for this whole movement.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she took a big risk. She was well-loved. And I think, that
and
was
still
the,
is. That's
right,
the key.
Yeah, that was that cognitive dissonance. People are like, well, I don't like gay people, but I like her.
Yeah. We've had a number of people who have responded to our promoting the fact that we're having this program today. And most of them talked about things that we've already discussed. But here's one that I think we should discuss. There should be cultural competency training for all police officers, city and county, on LGBT people and their live experiences, especially the trans and LGBT communities of color. What about this issue of law enforcement training? I mean, it seems to me that it's an important one.
Well, I'm actually working on a story right now about trans women of color and the dangers they face, including in their, some of them have told me, in their contact, you know, with law enforcement, how when someone, you know, discovers that maybe, you know, this person is not who they thought, you know, maybe upon a physical examination, they're going to, you know, put a trans woman into to a male prison. And or that really causes all kinds of problems and is a threat. So, you know, then there's the perception. And again, like this is something made fun of and not taken seriously. But this, you know, kind of thing can be a real danger to some people.
Why did the LGBT Center close?
I think, I don't have firsthand information from, but I think the trend nationally has been that because of, the modern world of technology, the center really was about providing resources and information. And so now that is much more easily obtained, you know, through, you know, your iPhone and the internet. So
it's a positive. We can
so
take
it's
a positive
somewhat of a positive.
That.
Yes and
is
no.
That there, mm-hmm. Yes and no, because there's still a need for a physical location, I believe, to have a common space for LGBT groups to meet, share resources. So I would hope that that effort would continue in the next year or so to look at what would that look like and how could all the LGBT groups who maybe are not working as closely together as they should all get together at a common space and work together. So that would be a good way to move forward.
Well, the Metro Trans Umbrella Group is actually very close on the heels of in their plans to open a center that is not only for trans people, but, you know, for the community, but has a particular focus on transgender people.
And Steve, what is the status of your LGBT historic project?
Well, it's great. We started back in 2007, and now we have important relationships in the community. We have archival partners at the State Historical Society at UMSL, with the Missouri History Museum, and with Washington University. So as we collect artifacts, they're able to preserve them and catalog them and keep them safe for the future. And so with that comes programming to do lectures and speaker series regarding various topics in the LGBT community. So we've come a long way from a simple blog to now a full-scale project that is really doing important research for, you know, St. Louis and the region.
I should point out, we only have a couple of seconds left, that your book, Gay and Lesbian St. Louis, is there's plenty of text, but it's primarily images. And I think people will get a kick out of seeing some of the history that you've got reflected here. And if they want to know more about it, they can catch up with you. I guess it's at Left Bank Books on February 29th, right? Is that at 7 o'clock is the normal time for those things?
Correct. Yeah, the book signing will be next Monday. And Left Bank's a very important historical location for the LGBT community. And so we're excited that they're going to host us next Monday.
So it's symbolic as well as practical,
needless
to say. All right. We'll give our regards to Chris Kleindienst when you're there.
Certainly will.
A good friend of ours. Nancy Fowler, thank you for being with us and sharing your story with us.
Thank you, Don.
Stephen, it's been a pleasure seeing you. Once again, the book is Gay and Lesbian St. Louis. Stephen Lewis Brawley is the author and also the founder of the St. Louis LGBT History Project here in St. Louis. Sorry about that. Thank you again for being with us. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/STL On Air. Thank you for being with us. I'm Don Marsh.